BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the television presenter, actor and entertainer Bradley Walsh. He's been a familiar face on our screens since the 90s, but in recent years, the sheer breadth of his output has reached critical mass. In case you're still catching up, his adventures include stand-up comedy, quiz shows including The Chase and Blankety Blank, Panto, big-budget dramas, Coronation Street, Doctor Who, and travel programmes which he co-presents with his son Barney. And then there's the singing. In 2016, he released the biggest-selling debut album by a British artist. He was born in Watford and was an apprentice engineer at the nearby Rolls-Royce factory making jet engines before signing for Brentford Football Club. When injury put an end to his dreams of playing for England, he decided to give entertainment a whirl. He became a blue coat at Pontins, doing the rounds at working men's clubs before turning professional in 1986. When asked what advice he would give to his 18-year-old self, he says, "Keep your feet on the ground, smile and turn up on time. Doing TV is not brain surgery, so don't think you're important. That said, you are making people happy, which is a great feeling." Bradley Walsh, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Oh, thanks, Laura. Yeah. Blimey, yeah, that's quite emotional to hearing that, I've got to say.
Yeah, it's quite tricky to get it all into one introduction. So many strings to your bow.
Yeah, I think what the thing is, if you set out going down one direction, you've got only one direction to go in, consequently. So if you spread yourself quite thinly, which I've managed to sort of do, then you can branch out. Because so many times within our industry, you get told no. And if you keep getting told no, what the thing to do is then is diversify as quick as you can.
Well, I want to dig into that and all of the many adventures that you've had. But let's start with that idea that you were talking about. Great to hear you giving yourself that sensible advice.
And right.
That thought of making people happy. I mean, how do you judge when you're getting that right?
You have to go through a transient period of where things aren't going quite right. And so consequently, you spend your time sort of dying on your backside, and then all of a sudden you get better, and it's a learning curve. And then once you hear the laughter, and once you hear people sort of enjoying themselves, and that becomes a bit like a drug, really.
Addictive.
Yeah, addictive is actually the right word. It becomes addictive, and you like to carry on hearing that. It's not about the applause, it's about the laughs, I think. And I've actually enjoyed people. It's not about talking at people, but more so being with them in the fact that we're sharing an experience. And because I like people, and I like people watching, and I like talking to people.
All right, well, let's dive in. What's your first choice going to be, and why?
My first choice is, this changed my outlook on music entirely. I was used to listening to stuff like late Beatles stuff, you know, and sort of the 60s and 50s music because of my family and things like that. And then all of a sudden, this guy came along, about 1968, 69, and then he releases this, Life on Mars, David Bowie. And to this day, I have absolutely no idea what the words mean. Rule Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog and clowns. What is going on? So I've got no idea. But all of a sudden, I thought, do you know what? You can actually write music that doesn't mean anything, but as long as it means something to you, it's all that matters.
But the film is a sad thing for, but she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools if they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's the freakiest show. Take a look at the law.
David Bowie and Life on Mars. So, Bradley Walsh, let's spool back a bit, shall we? You were born in Watford in 1960. Your dad, Danny, worked for a printing company, then as a roofer. How would you describe him and what was your relationship like?
Very funny man. I used to go and watch him play football and was very proud of him. He was a good local footballer, my dad. He was just a man's man. He back in the day in the 60s, they used to work all week. Then on a Friday at around 4 o'clock, they would go into a pub and then get home quite late, sort of 9-ish o'clock. And then on a Saturday morning, they'd probably get up, him and my mum, and would watch me play football for Saturday morning team with my school. And on a Saturday evening, he would sit in the club or the pub and drink. On a Sunday morning, he would then go and watch Sunday morning football. He would then sit in the pub until sort of 2 or 3 o'clock, come home, have his Sunday dinner, and then say to my mum, right, we're going out. And my mum's evening would be either going up the club or up the pub.
That was their kind of date night. But it doesn't sound like a lot of time for you to be with your dad then. Were the two of you close?
I don't think we'll be close. I'm not sure, looking back on it. We had a common ground, which, of course, was football. And as a man's man, I think he had, at the time, those sort of guys had time for the men. Do you know what I mean? They would rather be interested in talking about other stuff than spending a lot of time with the children.
Tell me about your mum then. So, Margaret, she was an auxiliary nurse.
And yeah, correct.
I know she worked at a local psychiatric hospital.
Correct, yeah.
I think you've credited her with your work ethic.
Oh, 100%. Her work ethic was extraordinary because I remember my mum, you know, would have like two or three jobs at one time to keep us going because my mum and dad separated.
So. Yes, you were 14 when that happened. That's... So she took on extra work.
Yeah, yeah. Not just the nursing. I think she worked in a canteen of some description. All sorts, really. I adopted the same thing because when I was younger, I ended up with about 4 jobs at one time.
You were a baker's boy, I think.
I was a baker's boy. You're absolutely right. So I'd get up at 4:30.
How old were you at this point?
I'd say 13. I'd help unload the van, stack all the shelves, ready for it to open. I would then go back home, go back to bed, reset the alarm, get up, go to school. It never did me any harm, but I had so much energy. And I always wondered back in the day if ever I had like an ADHD type thing.
So
I'd never been diagnosed.
You weren't a natural sleeper. You weren't a...
I was like a live wire.
Right.
I was like a firecracker in everything I did. And I ran everywhere. I ran everywhere.
Oh, Bradley, we've got to make a bit of time for the music. It's time for your second disc today. What have you gone for?
This harks back to my early days in Watford. It used to be a club called the Top Rank. We called it the Top Rank. This used to be a Saturday morning sort of dance hall. And we used to go as school kids, 13, you know, just running around like maniacs with a bit of Coca-Cola inside you and an ice cream, what used to be called an ice cream float on coke, a dollop of vanilla ice cream. And they used to play this song. And whenever they played this song, we'd all get up and just run about and jump and dart. And I never forget it. And it's called March of the Mods. And it's by the Joe Loss Orchestra. That was the song to get everyone out. And that was the worst song you could ever imagine because it used to be like setting a load of fireworks off.
Bedlam on
Bedlam.
The dance floor.
Bedlam.
I mean, imagine.
I used to go potty.
March of the Mods, the Joe Loss Orchestra. So, Bradley Walsh, you were the class clown at school, and when you were 14, your mum took you to the London Palladium.
Oh, wow.
And you saw Tommy Steele in Hans Andersen. I think it was quite an important moment for you, that.
It was a very important moment. I remember it vividly to this day. Playing opposite Tommy Steele was a young lad, and he was playing like the bosun, I think, or whatever, the first mate. And I said to my mum, look at that kid, that's what I want to be doing. That's where I need to be.
Back then, though, the aim for you was still football. That was plan A. And you were spotted quite young by Brentford FC.
Yeah.
They offered you a trial at the club. Tell me about that. How did it go?
I was playing for a local side called Leavesden Hospital, which was where my mum worked. My mum was a psychiatric nurse. And unbeknownst to me, Brentford had been watching me for a little while. And after the game, the groundsman and scout, a guy called Dave Bromley, came up to me and said, "We've been watching you for a few weeks. We want you to come and play at Brentford." And I said, "Oh, OK. Now, this is a Saturday afternoon." I said, "Oh, OK. Wow, I can't believe it. Fantastic." He said, "Yeah, it's Monday evening and you'll be playing against Southend United." Anyway, I end up having a drink after the game, then having a few more drinks, like I do on a Saturday night, playing just county football. Get up on a Sunday morning. I play football on a Sunday morning. Have a few drinks. I'm not married or nothing. I've got no kids or nothing. It's, you know, it's just a young lad. Go out Sunday night, have a few more drinks. Get up for work Monday morning. I go to work at Rolls-Royce in the factory. Bit of a hangover. I come home from work. I'm sitting in my mum's front room, seeing my mum, having a cup of tea. There's a knock on the door. I'm watching the telly. And my mum answers the door. She comes in and says, "Brad, there's someone here for you." And I walk to the door. And he goes, "Right, you ready?" And I went, "Oh, my God. Oh, so, oh, wow. So sorry, so sorry." We go to Griffin Park. I put my kit on. I go out and play. I have the game of my life.
Even with a two-day hangover?
Even that. I have the game of my life. I scored the winner. I finish. I come off. Bill Dodgin says to me, "Follow me." And then I've got my kit on, still my kit, all my boots, and he walks me up this oak staircase. There used to be an oak staircase at the back of the changing rooms and up to the director's box and director's lounge. Beautiful oak. So I walked all the way up in my kit, filthy dirty. And he said, "Do you want to sign for us?" And I went, "Sure." And he gives me a pen. He goes, "There you go. Sign there." He said, "For the rest of the season." So I signed, literally signed there and then, for the rest of the season to Brentford. And I signed the following season as well. So I had basically two seasons. I had probably about 50 games, something like that.
I mean, that is it was the stuff of dreams coming true for you. How did it feel?
It felt great. I felt elated and I couldn't really believe it, to be honest with you.
Bradley, it's time for some more music. Disc number three. What are we going to hear?
I did a school assembly as one of the Bay City Rollers with a few friends and we mimed to this song, dressed as the Bay City Rollers.
You had the full gear on.
The whole gear. We made it ourselves and I was the drummer. We used to have high-waisted trousers.
The kind of crop flares.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is Bye Bye Baby. And because of this, I ended up in school plays because of this.
If you hate me after all I say, just gotta tell her anyway.
Oh, the Bay City Rollers, yeah. Bradley Walsh, and Bye Bye Baby.
Oh, my goodness.
So tell me then about life after school. Obviously, you know, at that point you were still dreaming of being a footballer.
Yeah.
You started to become interested in performing before an audience, mm-hmm. but actually there was a real job that you were pursuing.
Yeah.
You were an apprentice at Rolls-Royce, making jet engines.
Yeah, true. Best thing I ever did in that respect.
Way?
Well, because I went to their technical college. And I learnt how to do everything. So my proper education came there. Oh, that's how that works. Ah. Oh, that's how that flies. I get it.
And you kept working there once you'd signed to Brentford.
Yeah, because Brentford always said to me, Bill Johnson said, "Have you got a trade to fall back on in case it don't work for you?" And I said, "Well, I'm at Rolls-Royce as an apprentice, so I can. They'll let me go to college." And he went, "That's perfect."
I mean, it sounds, Bradley, like life was really coming together for you.
Yeah.
You were getting to do work that you really enjoyed. You were getting to play football. You know, you were doing so professionally.
Yeah.
It must have been absolutely crushing when you got the news that Brentford were letting you go.
Yeah. The thing is, Lauren, I was coming back from injury and I'd spent too much time on the bench. And we'd had a new manager come in called Fred Callahan. And he said, "The holiday's over." He said, "I haven't come here to win friends." He said, "I've come here to get us out of the third division." I'd fractured my ankle about 3 months prior to that, 4 months prior to that. And then after 3 months, I'd fractured the other ankle. So I was really struggling. And he said, "I'm letting you go." And he fired me. I was devastated.
Mm.
I was devastated. Strangely enough, fast forward about 37 years, and I'm at a charity dinner. And all my pals, a lot of my pals are footballers now anyway. They became footballers and we remain friends. And I get a phone call. Les Strong's phone goes whilst we're sitting having this dinner. He said, here. He said, I've got someone sitting next to me who you'll know. I said to Les, who is it? He put his hand over the phone and he said, it's Fred Callaghan, the manager who'd sacked me all those years ago. Oh. And I went, hello, Fred. And he went, who's that? I said, it's Bradley Walsh. He laughed his head off. He went, I'll bet you're glad I sacked you now.
What did you say?
I just laughed. I said, thanks very much, Fred. Proper, you did me a proper turn, mate.
But, I mean, so gutting for you at the time.
Well,
21 years old. What, did you have a plan?
No, no plan. I went and finished my time off at Rolls. I went back to Rolls Royce, finished my time off. But my friend Bob Booker then said, come on, we'll go on holiday. Took us away. We all went away, seven of us. And we went to Mallorca, Cala Mosquita, Holiday Club, Continental. And they said, Brad, enter the talent competition. Do your Norman Wisdom impression in your Wurzel Gummidge. Because all the holidaymakers were English. So I said, all right, yeah. And I did. And I won. And a guy comes up to me afterwards. He says, have you ever thought about getting into the entertainment industry? I went, no. He said, do yourself a favour. When you get back to England, get an audition and become a blue coat at Pontins. And that's exactly what I did.
We'll find out what happened next. After your next disc, I think, Bradley Walsh. Number four, what have you got for us?
We were teenagers. And we had this flat in Watford. Myself, Steve Kelly, who we call Harry, and Chrissy Brennan, Rambo, because he looked like Rambo, built like a, you know, a train. And Steve Kelly, my mate Harry, he worked for the old GPO. And he said, I should paint my van, because GPO vans were yellow. I said, I'll paint it for you. And I paint his van.
You've got a twinkle in your eye.
But I paint his van with white gloss. And it's white. And I think, that looks pretty cool. I've done a nice job of that. I know what it needs. So I get a tin of brown paint. And I sign write, Steve Kelly and the Steve Kelly Band on tour. This next track became our signature tune. Me and my mates, after a drink and a skinful, used to perform this at Rolls Royce Sports and Social Club for everyone and pretend we were 10cc. I'm Mandy, fly me.
Just like a stone, I'm outside looking in, but if your chance came, would you take it? Where on earth do I begin? I'm Mandy, fly me.
I'm Mandy, fly me. So, Bradley Walsh, yeah. Let's talk then about taking your first steps into comedy. You'd got the bug. You started performing on the Working Men's Club circuit. Yeah. What was your act back then?
It was mainly impressions and it was mainly standard jokes. This fella walks into a pub, that sort of stuff. And I'm not sure I was learning. I didn't really start learning until I actually went to Blackpool. I used to then write about the local area and that's all of a sudden it became observational. And the Horseshoe Show Bar, it was on the Pleasure Beach, was a fantastic room for comics. That was a 20-week season. Mm. So by the time, at the end of the first month, you've got rid of all the rubbish you don't need, all of a sudden, you're like, you're away.
This is the 80s, of course. And
Back in the day, the new wave, what was called the new wave comedy, the alternative comedy
exactly.
was coming through.
This has all been born. Were you ever tempted to go down that avenue? Was there much crossover?
I was. And back in the time, they came to me and can I do the comedy store? They never used to ask people like me to do it.
And how did it go?
Well, all right. It was fine, you know. And I went on a tour for Don Wood at the Comedy Store and went down to the Kilkenny Comedy Festival and stuff like that. Mm. It was good. And I enjoyed the Edinburgh Festival. But I felt that I saw a niche. There was a time when they'd stopped having performers on television. They didn't want Monkhouse anymore. They didn't want Bruce Forsyth anymore. And then all of a sudden, that left a massive gap. Someone who could do a bit of stand-up comedy, think on their feet, become a bit of a one-stop shop. If you needed a song, they could do it. If they needed to be with the general public and work, they could do it. No one was doing that at the time. Mm. And that was a niche that needed filling. And I thought, that's where I need to be.
And it's interesting that, you know, you mention comics like Bob Monkhouse. I think Des O'Connor was a mentor of yours at the time. Did those guys give you advice?
All the time. I once did a Raw Variety. And I was in a dressing room and I was with Ronnie Corbett, Des O'Connor, Bruce Forsyth and Jimmy Tarbuck. And Bruce Forsyth couldn't do his cufflinks up. And so Ronnie Corbett said, he said, well, I'll do your cufflinks for you. I'll do your cufflinks. And Bruce is going, I can't do my cufflinks. I can't do my cufflinks. And Des said something to Bruce along the lines of, if it had been one of the Beverly sisters, you'd have got your cufflinks done up quick enough or something like that. He said, don't you start, Desmond. He said, you wait till the boy gets here. Don't say anything in front of the boy. And I'm thinking, what boy? Who are they talking about? Anyway, he's coming, the boy's coming, here comes the boy, and in walks Jimmy Tarbuck, the boy who was younger than him, and he was 74. And he's the boy. So what does that make me? Do you know what I mean? Well, you don't say where the boy gets here. And I just sat there watching them all night.
You must have been lapping it up.
Oh, it was fabulous.
Time for some more music, Bradley. Number five, what's it going to be, and why are you taking it to the island?
Okay, I'm now primarily a stand-up comic. I'm going to drive to Ringmer in Sussex. I have to go down and see my Uncle John and my Auntie Iris, literally who lived in Gandersash, 10 doors down the road from us, before I leave. I have to go and see them. And my Auntie Iris says to me, she said, do you listen to music on the way down there? I said, I do, yeah. She said, what do you listen to? I said, well, you know, bit of Bob Marley, bit of this, bit of that. She said, take this, and gives me a cassette. That cassette was played about 6 or 7 times on the way down. So much so, I went round the block when I got to the Roebuck Inn and sat in the car park so the tape could finish. Firefly, Tony Bennett, has become my favourite singer of all time.
I call her Firefly, 'cause oh my, she radiates moon glow. Wants none of that noon glow. She starts to glitter when the sun goes down, about 8 p.m. It's mayhem. She switches the brights up, lights up, and gives me a call. Take me to the Firefly's ball. But when I get her there, set her there, do I get to bed her there and grab me some glow? No, she's a god about mad about Laura.
Tony Bennett and Firefly.
Yeah.
So, Bradley Walsh, in 1986, you decided to take the leap and go professional full-time.
Yes.
It wasn't a small decision. You know, you had a young family to support.
Yes.
Did you have any qualms about taking that step?
I did, but you know what? For those of us who wear a comfy coat the entire time, you'll stay warm, but wearing a comfy coat doesn't really help you spread your wings. So after that, in 86, I got a job at Cromer.
This is your first booking, a 3-year stint at the Pavilion Theatre on Cromer Pier. And then after that, you worked in Blackpool. You then went on tour as a support act for some huge artists, Shirley Bassey, Leo Sayer, and later Sir Tom Jones. I wonder about, you know, the Tom Jones gig. How did that go?
That was my first big step up. Phil Baldry, one of the legendary tour managers of our time, he was Tom Jones's tour manager. And I was told to get on and do my 25 minutes. I'd never been in front of 11,000 people.
You must have been terrified.
I was terrified. I mean, terrified. And what Tom used to do, Tom used to have to leave his hotel, get in the car, literally pull up, have 2 minutes standing there, not hang around, get on, hear his opening music and go on. The timing was to the second. It was like a military operation. This didn't help. The intro I got, now 11,000 people, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Tom Jones in concert. And everyone's stamping their feet. But first, and the audience went, ah, oh. But first, please welcome Tom's very special guest, Bradley Walsh, thinking it's going to be a band. And I walk on my own. Whoa, I tell you. Anyway, I came off. Let's say I did 15 minutes. It wasn't brilliant, I have to say, because once you start realising you're not going too well, what happens is you really ultimately can't help yourself. But you're actually going to clip again. That's what happens. You just, and your lips go dry. You do.
Yeah.
Awful. I think, thank you very much. Enjoy, Tom. And you walk off. Phil Baldry is standing right there backstage. He went, where are you going? I went, I've done it. I couldn't. He said, get back out there. I went, no. He said, Tom's not here. Get back out there. I said, I can't do any more. I don't know. He said, out. And he got me, turned me round, pushed me. And I went back on stage in front. And then I started doing a load of stuff, just to ad-libbing a load of stuff, and sort of got away with it till Tom arrived. That then, I thought, hello, this is now a bit of improv. I am now, all of a sudden, I started working in a different type of way.
So it came together.
It sort of came together. It wasn't brilliant.
Yeah.
It came together, but I learned how to work those big arenas.
Bradley, I'm going to take a moment for some more music. This is your sixth choice.
Yeah.
What is it and why are you taking it to your desert island?
The amount of times I've spent on my own, just driving to and from gigs, sometimes sleeping in the car. And I remember just before the Royal Variety Performance in 1993, my first Royal, my management company put me on the road with Neil Sedaka. And I'd got a Neil Sedaka album and I listened to this track. Oh, wow, this is a great, this is, says it all. And we were in Brighton Conference Centre and I said, and Neil Sedaka come up to me, he said, you're enjoying the tour, Brad? I said, I am. I said, you know, you never play The Hungry Years, do you? Everyone in our industry should listen to that song. I said, remember where they've come from. And he went, do you know what? I'll play that for you tonight. So we went on stage and he sat at the piano and he said, this next song is for my mate Brad.
I miss the hungry years, the once upon a time, the lovely long ago. We didn't have a dime. Those days of me and you, we lost along the way.
The Hungry Years by Neil Sedaka. Bradley Walsh, in 2009, you started hosting the ITV quiz show The Chase.
Yes.
It has gone on to be hugely successful.
Huge.
With multiple TV awards, spawning numerous spin-offs.
Mm-hmm.
But what made you say yes when ITV's Alison Sharman first talked to you about the project?
I was doing Law and Order. The reviews were great, but I missed entertainment. I missed it. I miss working in studio. I miss the quickness of it. I miss the... because it's very tedious on a drama
there's
set.
There's a lot of waiting to do your bit.
Oh, there's a lot of waiting. And she said, well, what do you want to do? I said, what have you got? She said, hang on a minute. And she presses this button. She gets on the phone. She goes, Di, to Di Howie. She says, Di Howie. She said, Di, bring that thing in, that bit of paper, that thing we got yesterday. I went, oh, I like it. She went, right, well, take it home and digest it because, you know, and tell me what you think. I said, well, hang on, what are you going to do with it? She went, well, we're thinking of making a pilot, but we've got to do an office run. I said, I'll do your office run-through. She went, you're joking. I said, I'll do your office run-through for you. Come to the office run-through. I've now got the bosses of ITV there. I've got a table in front of me, and I've got Sean Wallace, who became the Dark Destroyer, in front of me, and I've got Mark Labette, Sue Chase is there, right? So I said to Mark Labette, first of all, I said, right, Mark, I said, that's an unusual name, French Labette. He said, I know, it stands for the Beast. I said, well, that's what you are then. You're the Beast. I said to Sean Wallace, Sean, what do you like? He said, I love boxing. I said, well, he said, who's your favourite boxer? He said, Nigel Benn, Dark Destroyer. I said, you're now the Dark Destroyer. And what I did was I played. I said, this is easy. Anyone could win this. And they went, well, take them on then, if you're so clever. I had all the questions on a piece of A4 paper. But under the A4 paper was the answers face down. So I took the other pieces of A4 paper, and because the table was slightly lit from underneath, I could see the answers.
You could read the answers.
I could see the answers. I could see the answers.
Bradley Walsh.
What's the point of swatting up when you can see the answers? So when I had my hands on the piece of paper, I just stand there, and I kept moving my hands. So I was masking it. You know, what's the capital of da-da-da-da? Who's the da-da-da? Job done. And I've just nailed them. And I beat them. Anyway, got the job.
Bradley, I think we'd better make time for another disc. It's your seventh today. Tell us about it.
When we were talking about The Hungry Years and Neil Sedaka and where you were, and you need someone to make that journey with you. And this song is my wedding song. This was our first dance, and it's Always and Forever by a great band called Heatwave. This is for me and Donna. And this is the person... I hope everyone's got someone like their loved one, their wife, their partner, and someone like Donna they can make that journey with.
Take time to tell me you really care.
He Heat Wave and Always and Forever for your wife, Donna Bradley Walsh. 30 years together this year.
30 years, yeah. Always and Forever.
Family is obviously very important to
you.
And
of
it's interestingly spawns one of the recent successes that you've had on screen, the series Breaking Dad. It's you and your son Barney who travelled around the world together in an RV, and he puts you through various challenges from skydiving to bobsleighing and everything in between. And it is so different from the kind of, you know, what we call shiny floor shows that you do. Do you think that it revealed more about your relationship with Barney than you expected?
I mean, I loved going on holiday with my son. I love going on holiday when we have family holidays and taught him to swim and playing and reading stories to him. I don't ever remember my dad reading a story to me, but I love reading stories and when he was younger and doing the voices and making up stories. And when you look at the relationship that I had with my dad, this is a different ball game entirely, and this is how it should be.
Bradley, you once described yourself as an odd job man, and right from the beginning, you have really made the most of the chances that you've been offered. Where does that reluctance to turn work down come from, and that drive that you've obviously
got? I think it's a working class thing. You're always worried, no matter how well you... If I was to win, if I'd have just made today $100 million on Bitcoin, I'd still be wondering where my next beans on toast was coming from. I'll always be that baker's boy. I'll always be collecting bottles as a kid, knowing you're going to get threepence back on them, the empties, and taking them up the thing, collecting them around the back. I don't know what... It's a work ethic.
And, of course, you have a new adventure coming very shortly. You are off to the desert island in just a moment. I wonder how you feel about the challenges of living there. Will you be up to it?
The thing I would miss most, I guess, would be family.
Barney won't be there to cheer you up.
No, he wouldn't. He wouldn't. He wouldn't.
Well, one more disc before we send you to your island, Bradley.
OK.
What's it going to be?
It can only be the one song. It says everything about me, I think. I imagine when I'm long gone or on the day I go, they'll be playing this at the funeral, I guess. I love it. It's a great tune. That's life. Frank Sinatra.
I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. Each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life.
That's life.
I tell you.
Wow.
Wow. Frank Sinatra, and That's Life. So, Bradley Walsh, I'm going to send you away to the island now.
OK.
I'm giving you the books to take with you, the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare and one other book of your choice. What would you like?
Oh, it can only be in one book. The Count of Monte Cristo. You know, the last words in The Count of Monte Cristo is wait and hope. Just wait and hope in life. Wait and hope. Something will happen.
Especially on a desert island. That's
especially on
choice.
A desert island.
You must have that book. You can also have a luxury item to make life more pleasurable. What will that be?
Golf clubs. I started playing golf when I was 19. I've never got any better because I've never had enough time to devote to it. Now there would be enough time.
Finally, which one track of the eight that you've shared with us today would you save from the waves if you had to?
If it was only me and a desert, it would have to be Always and Forever. It would have to be, because then your loved ones are always with you.
Bradley Walsh, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Laura.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Brad. We'll leave him practising his golf swing and entertaining the seagulls, shall we? We've cast away many stand-ups and presenters in the past, including Sarah Millican and Joe Brand, Davina McCall and Richard Osman. And why not listen to some of Bradley's mentors while you're at it? Ronnie Corbett, Bruce Forsyth, Jimmy Tarbuck and Des O'Connor. They're all in the archive too. You can find them if you search through BBC Sounds or on our programme website. The studio manager for today's programme was Sarah Hockley. The assistant producer was Christine Pavlovsky, and the producer was Paula McGinley. Next time, my guest will be the Paralympian swimmer Ellie Simmons. I do hope you'll join us.
I'm Sean Keaveney, and I'm here to tell you about my new BBC Sounds and Radio 4 podcast, Your Place or Mine, the travel show that's going nowhere. I get to stay on my comfy sofa talking to you fine people, and excellent guests join us bringing their stories about the best bits of the planet right here.
Were you one of those people secretly delighted by at least some aspects of the lockdown then?
Maybe. And welcome, Izzy Lawrence, our resident voice of reason, travel guru, comedian, historian and geographer.
Hello. You do know the guests are going to try very hard to convince you to go to these places, Sean.
Well, it's probably not going to happen. Sweaty tropics and polluting long-haul flights, no thanks.
Well, this is going to be interesting then.
It's going to be fun. To join us in our trip around the world from the comfort of your very own sofa, subscribe to Your Place or Mine on BBC Sounds.